Asian Studies here at GW. Our roundtable today is on building cross-strait military confidence-building measures, a goal between far and near. We have three panelists. I'm just going to give a very short introduction in the order in which they are going to appear, and then I'm just going to turn it over to them and hope that we'll have time for questions when they get done. So our first speaker is going to be Alan Romberg, who's the Distinguished Fellow and Director of the East Asia Program at the Stimson Center. He spent 27 years at the State Department, 20 years of that as a Foreign Service Officer. Lots and lots of other positions I don't want to go through. He had lots of them, including 10 years, though, as the Star Senior Fellow for Asian Studies at the Council for Foreign Relations. Then our second speaker is going to be Da-Jong Lee, who's Associate Professor of the Graduate Institute of International Affairs and Strategic Studies at Tanjiang University in Taiwan. He got his PhD from the Fletcher School at Tufts and is currently a Fulbright Visiting Scholar here at the Seeger Center. And then finally, Bonnie Glazer, a Senior Advisor for Asia and the Freeman Chair at China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's also, I guess, a Senior Associate for their Pacific Forum, longtime consultant with the U.S. government, and also a long list of other things she's done that I don't want to talk about in detail. But I think a lot of you already know all of our panelists here in one way or the other. So without further ado, I will turn the panel over to them. Alan? And you can either sit or stand, whatever you feel you want to do.
This on? Hello? Up? Yes? Okay. Okay, I apologize to those sitting over here, but I'd rather do this sitting here rather than standing at the rostrum there. I'm sort of the odd man out in this particular setting because I'm not going to talk specifically about CBMs, but I'm going to try and talk a little bit about various factors in the strategic setting in which to consider. Both sides need to consider, and others as well, what's possible and what's smart. Obviously, a lot has changed since 2008 with the advent of the Ma administration in Taiwan, the re-election of Barack Obama, and I would also argue the evolution of the situation on the mainland. In terms of cross-strait relations, I think that the changes since 2008 really has affected PRC goals. In the Chen Shui-bian era, between 2000 and 2008, the mainland moved in its goals from pursuing unification to blocking independence. And so the focus was on what is possible and necessary, not necessarily, at least from Beijing's point of view, what was desirable. Now, however, with Ma Ying-jeou in office, Taiwan independence is out. My sense is that Beijing has focused more on what it desires and is pushing more for political dialogue. It understands, I think, the limits in Taiwan, both in terms of public opinion and in terms of Ma Ying-jeou's political situation. But nonetheless, it is clear that it wants political dialogue over time, and that is a specific goal. International space requires consultation, they say. That's a form of political dialogue. Ma has said that creation of the CEF and ARIT's reciprocal offices is actually a form of political dialogue. So things are moving ahead. It's not that they're totally static in terms of the goals that Beijing is setting out. And tensions obviously have significantly abated, but the latent use of force remains. That is, on the one hand, it obviously has been a long time since Beijing really threatened to use force. For example, the 2000 white paper, in which the three ifs included that if negotiations for unification didn't take place within a given period of time, then that might raise the possible use of force. But I think it's also reasonable to argue that the possession of a threat has been seen in Beijing as an element in keeping Taiwan from opting for independence and for keeping support for the status quo high. I'd add parenthetically how the prospect of the election of a possible DPP administration in 2016 that has not committed to some sort of one China might affect all of this, how it might affect all of this is something to consider for the future. But that possibility, I would argue, does have some relevance even today in terms of how Beijing approaches some of the issues. So I think that's why Beijing believes it is important to maintain a credible deterrent to Taiwan independence, and that affects the larger strategic picture. Even though I believe the possibility of any Taiwan leadership, including a DPP leadership, moving toward de jure independence is somewhere between 0 and minus 70, I also think Beijing fears the consequences of simply saying it would not use force in any circumstances. Hence, until the day of unification, the PLA is going to be required to maintain a capability to deal with any movement toward Taiwan independence if the leadership in Beijing calls on it to do so. And, of course, this has major implications for Taiwan's own defense preparedness and for U.S. security ties with Taiwan, including arms sales, and, as my colleagues will discuss, specifically for CBMs. In terms of the regional picture, while in the Chen Shui-bian era, other nations actually went some distance to indicate that they would not support the United States if we were to get enmeshed in a cross-strait confrontation, which was seen as only likely to come out of Taiwan provocation. Obviously, you don't hear anything about that these days. Of course, that is largely because, and overwhelmingly, I would guess, because no one thinks there will be a military clash. But these days, one would have to assume, if you're thinking about contingencies, as a lot of people get paid to do, that any cross-strait confrontation would come from some kind of assertive or aggressive PRC behavior, not from Taiwan provocation. So while we shouldn't assume active participation by another country in such contingency would take place, the facts at the time could well change the calculation. It's hard to know. For most purposes, of course, this is all quite hypothetical. But even if one were to assume that military confrontation by movement toward Taiwan independence is off the table, nonetheless, there is a concern among some people that Beijing will lose patience at some point. PRC scholars speculate about this all the time, some even predicting that that moment could come sooner rather than later. But even if the prospect is not near-term, the long-term issue of so-called peaceful separation, or He Ping Fan Liet, is not just a concern of some of the more colorful writers in the PRC, such as Luo Yuan. Another strategic factor is that the PRC has increasingly taken on other security challenges unrelated to Taiwan, challenges it was not either physically or politically prepared to take on in the past. Hence, while the Pentagon still sees Taiwan as the focal point of most PLA modernization, it's clear that other requirements are also emerging. And this has to have some effect on the PRC calculus about how to deal with Taiwan. Now, I would caution against assuming that this means Beijing would not be prepared to, as it were, do the necessary if any of the three terms of the March 2005 anti-secession law were to come into being. Just to remind us all, Article 8 said that in the event that the Taiwan independent secessionist forces should act under any name or by any means to cause the fact of Taiwan's secession from China, so secession is one, or major incidents entailing Taiwan's secession from China should occur, two, or three, that possibilities for peaceful reunification should be completely exhausted, then they would employ non-peaceful means and other necessary measures. I think all those terms are actually quite vague and open to interpretation, and that's why I think it all also depends on the general political climate in which such an interpretation would be rendered. But we can see that as the PRC's economic strength has grown and its role in the region and in the world has grown with it, its vision of its strategic interests has also broadened. This has relevance, obviously, to what it's doing as far away as patrolling the Gulf of Aden against pirates and so forth. But it has particular relevance closer to home in terms of the East China Sea and the South China Sea. I don't believe Beijing's looking for a fight, and I think it really would hope to achieve its goals by diplomacy or potentially by muscling its way around without calling on the PLA per se. But even if it has bit its tongue, including having altered transcripts of foreign ministry press briefings, to avoid saying that those areas, the East and South China Sea, are like Tibet, like Xinjiang, like Taiwan, matters of core interest, it's very clear that issues of sovereignty and territorial integrity are, in fact, involved and do meet the definition of core interest. So my point is, having committed to protect interests in certain regional areas beyond Taiwan, it has to consider the possibility of being drawn into some sort of confrontation as it weighs its separate options, as it were, for dealing with Taiwan itself. One example, we know, for example, that Tokyo's commitment that it fully understands and respects the position of the PRC, that Taiwan is, and these are their words, an inalienable part of the territory of the People's Republic of China. Nonetheless, both overall strategic competition between China and Japan and the importance which many Japanese attach to maintaining regional stability and balance as they have been are of great significance. And as Beijing has sought to enlist Taiwan in common cause to protect Chinese interests in the region, one needs to be realistic to understand that Tokyo's agreement this spring to a fisheries agreement with Taiwan, one which was quite favorable to Taiwan fishermen after years of resisting doing so, was not unrelated to Japan's concern to prevent just such a coalition across the strait at a time of high controversy over the Senkaku's Diaoyutai issue. So, third country issues exist that also have direct relevance to the strategic situation affecting cross-strait relations. On the U.S. factor, my own view is that Taiwan is not really a direct player in the U.S. strategy of rebalancing to Asia. Despite PRC suspicions to the contrary, the American relationship with Taiwan is not part of some American strategy to constrain China and to limit its power and influence, much less to back some version of Taiwan independence. But of course, maintenance of peace and stability in the Western Pacific, including in the Taiwan Strait, is a crucial aspect of American security policy and has been for decades. So arms sales and other security relationships with Taiwan have relevance to the goals of maintaining peace and stability. As to Washington's attitude toward cross-strait reconciliation in general, while the U.S. obviously would be concerned about any steps that might alter the strategic stability in the region, it seems unlikely in the extreme, as in it won't happen, that Taipei would agree to arrangements that did that. So with that as an underlying reality, the U.S. has made clear in a number of ways that it favors political and security dialogue between the two sides. I think Bonnie's going to go into that in more detail, so I won't. But my point is that from a strategic perspective, while the U.S. is not being pushy, and it has been supportive of such efforts and has not, as some in the mainland believe, opposed them out of concern that they would upset regional stability. Finally, obviously, an enormously important factor in the strategic climate is the evolving relationship directly between the U.S. and China. We're all clear that the military relationship has tended to lag other dimensions, though it seems to me there may be even some constructive shift there. But at a political level, both leaderships understand the fundamental importance of working together on a range of issues of mutual interest. Hence, neither will compromise on vital interest, but both have sought to manage even the most sensitive issues, such as Taiwan, in a way that avoids generating confrontation and that contributes to contribute to instability. Obviously, issues remain. Some of them are of direct relevance to Taiwan. For example, American close-in reconnaissance. Moreover, although Beijing continues to object to arms sales and warn about their harmful effect, that therefore remains an issue. But what we also see is a recognition that we need to manage those issues in ways that enhance the potential for cooperation or at least avoiding confrontation. And so Beijing has increasingly been willing to tailor its reaction to the specifics of the situation, not simply have a knee-jerk reaction as it has at times in the past to cut off this or that activity, generally in the military-to-military realm. I think that the U.S. convinced Beijing in the Chen Shui-bian era that it does not favor or support Taiwan independence. So if the two sides miraculously agreed to it, we would certainly be quite happy to go along with it. And this situation has eased strategic tensions, this conviction about the American view of independence. I believe that has been to the benefit of Taiwan's security and of cross-strait relations. What we obviously haven't convinced Beijing of is that we really, as we frequently say, would be willing to accept any outcome arrived at between the two sides peacefully, willingly, and without coercion. And I think convincing Beijing of that is a long-term enterprise. My point is that even though Taiwan remains a potential source of trouble in Washington-Beijing ties, theoretically, even a source of conflict, the situation across the strait in U.S.-PRC relations and in U.S.-Taiwan relations has evolved to a point where all three parties are being careful not to create turmoil or crisis. To the contrary, they're seeking to consolidate a situation of peace and stability. And in this setting, while of obvious continuing sensitivity, it seems to me, it's not out of the question that over time, certain kinds of CBMs might be considered. I'll stop with that.
Okay, thanks. It's open.
I think it's open.
Okay. I think today's my talks will be divided by two parts. The first part is about past efforts and current situation about building cross-strait CBMs. And the second part is about my explanations, why Taiwan is so reluctant to engage in cross-strait CBMs. So I think I will focus more on the second part. First of all, we know that building cross-strait CBMs is not a new idea or new concept. I think both sides across the two straits have talked this issue for a long, long time. For example, for Taiwan, as early as the 1990s, mid-1990s, Taiwan's National Unification Council did issue a statement urging the two sides to build this kind of mechanism. And in 1998, 1999, in different locations, the Li Denghui administration repeated this kind of proposal to Beijing. And during the Chen Shui-bian administration between 2000 and 2008, Taiwan's biennial National Defense Report proposed the kind of proposal for both sides to engage this kind of issue. And for the Chinese side, I think there are a number of important official statements, policy announcements, such as Hu Jintao's Hu 4 points, and Lian Zhan, Hu Jintao's joint statement, and Hu Jintao's 6 points in 2005 and 2008. And all of these important documents did mention about the need for both sides to explore the feasibility to build cross-strait CBMs. So now, what is the result? I think, as you know, there was no important breakthrough over the past 15 or 20 years. Although each side, Taipei and Beijing, made their unilateral movements, has its own past announcements, the result, achievement, was quite limited. I think the major reason is that there was no sufficient political mutual trust between the two sides. This is very fundamental. I think so. Where are we now? I think as just Alan just mentioned, since 2008, I think the two sides across Taiwan Strait have been moving forward. There have been more than a dozen agreements, memos, between Taiwan's ACF and China's ARATS in different issue dimensions, such as transportation, direct flights, investment, finance. So I think currently, Ma Ying-jeou administration in Taiwan tried to carry out cross-strait negotiations based on several important principles, such as from easy to difficult, from economic to political, and from urgent to less urgent. But still, some argue that the cross-strait negotiations is moving forward to a new phase, so-called deep water zone. That means it will involve more difficulties, challenges, and uncertainties for Taiwan. And over the past several years, I think we do believe witness that Beijing imposed greater pressures on Taiwan to push forward to the issue of political dialogues between the two sides. And on the other hand, I think Taiwan's response to these kind of proposals, pressures, with a very cold attitude. Actually, I think there have been a very subtle change from Taiwan's earlier position. We know that between 2008 and 2010, there was a lot of serious discussion, a heated debate, and some of then our governmental-sponsored discussions, research, and study in this field. But since then, I think Taiwan's attitude toward building cross-strait CBMs has been more conservative, trying to stay away from these kind of issues. So basically, I think now there are three explanations behind this. The first one is Taiwan's domestic politics. The second one is the considerations, Taiwan's considerations related to cross-strait interactions and cross-strait relations. The third one is so-called U.S. factor, as Alan just mentioned. For the first part, I think number one we need to know is that it's about the issue of military morale. I mean, one of Taiwan's biggest concerns. We know that over the past several years, a lot of Taiwan's retired officers, including those very high-ranking personnel, have been invited to China mainland to participate in different kind of seminars, workshop, conferences to discuss the issue of military CBM and other related issues. Of course, we know that none of them have the official authorization or any kind of mandate. But still, these kind of things incur some controversies and some critics in Taiwan society. Basically, I think there are two kinds of opinions on that. The first one is that Taiwan is a democracy, mature democracy. So that means everyone has his or her own right to express their political opinion and do whatever they want to do, as long as these are not violating regulation or related laws. In addition, I think some argue that these retired generals do represent a certain portion of Taiwan voices. And I think the intention of these majority of retired generals are still benign. They do believe that they can communicate with their PLA, People's Liberation Army's counterparts. They can educate them, and by doing this, they can contribute to the peace, stability across Taiwan Strait. The first view is this. And the second view is different. They think it's not a good thing. And some of them are directly from Taiwan's military, from those active duty officers. The reason? Because for a long time, I think how to prepare Taiwan to defend, deter a possible attack from China mainland has long been the number one mission for ROC, Armed Forces, Taiwan military. So even if we have a much better cross-strait relations, the primary source of military attack remain changed. So that means that this kind of concern in Taiwan. And when the media reports that some of these retired generals are shaking hands, playing golf with their PLA counterparts, you can imagine the negative impacts of that on Taiwan's military morale. So these things are still very controversial, different viewpoints about this. So it's the number one issue. The number two issue, I think, is about the consensus in Taiwan. I think the majority of Taiwanese people welcome cross-strait political reconciliation, more economic cooperation, integration, economics, cultural, exchanges. These are good. But still, I think the mainstream of public opinion in Taiwan still supports maintain the status quo in political terms. And CBN is not like ECFA, Economic Cooperation, a framework agreement. It's still different. It's more complicated and more political sensitive. So that's the reason why the Ma-Ying-jeou government tried to pursue a much more prudent, cautious approach to do this, because the reason is quite simple. There is no consensus, enough consensus in Taiwan society. So number two issue is this. And number three issue, I think, is about urgency, about the need. Some people argue that there's no urgent need for the two sides to discuss these kind of issues because of the current much more stable and positive cross-strait relations. Of course, the kind of issue, I think, is quite tricky. Because remember, when was the first time for Taiwan to propose this kind of suggestion to Beijing? The answer is, was in the 1990s, in the midst and in the aftermath of the Taiwan-Strait missile crisis. So that means at that time, there was an urgent need for Taiwan to try to stabilize cross-strait relations, try to avoid accidental conflicts, try to reduce the risk of misperception and misjudgment between the two sides. But when, it's very ironic, when the cross-strait relations moving forward to a much better track, the incentives behind Taiwan to push for this kind of issue is becoming less and less. Oh, so it's very interesting to do this. Like, we are doing so good. Why bother? Why do we need to touch this kind of difficult issue? So these are the third points. And then the next issue is about Taiwan's conservation regarding cross-strait interactions and cross-strait relations. I think the number one issue is that I think Taiwan tried to take the initiative, to take a lead, to control the pace, to set an agenda of cross-strait negotiations, rather than being led by China. So that means I think Taiwan is carefully choosing the right issues on the negotiation table that can best serve Taiwan's interest. So I think that the top priorities in for Ma-Ying-jeou administration may include to deepen the ECFA, try to set up the representative office in each other territories. So these are Taiwan's priorities. Apparently, CBN is not on the list, says number one. Number two, I think, is about some of Beijing's insistences. And Taiwan regard these insistences as the major barriers to pursue cross-strait CBMs. For example, as I think Alan just mentioned, Beijing continued to refuse renouncing the use of force and the threat to use force against Taiwan. Article 8 of the anti-secession law passed in 2005 was only one of these cases. So in Taiwan's views, this is exactly the major barrier. And we believe that Beijing will reserve every right approach to resolve cross-strait political disputes, including those peaceful and non-peaceful means. Another issue is about, I think, about the nature of state-to-state or nation-to-nation of building cross-strait CBMs. I believe Beijing will try its best to prevent such a kind of cross-strait CBM engaging any framework that goes beyond the bilateral arrangement, including any kind of international supervision or any role played by the U.S. But Taiwan's view is quite different. Taiwan do think that the U.S. should play a certain kind of role, if possible, such a guarantor, supervisor, or consultant, these kind of things. At least Taiwan wants to, the U.S. to be fully aware of every detail of the building cross-strait CBNs. throughout the whole process. So you can imagine the difference, how big. And the last thing is about, I think it's about, very important, it's about different goals between the two sides. I think for Taiwan, CBN can be positive under certain conditions. CBN is good because it can promote mutual understandings, mutual communications, and mutual trust. CBN can be good because it can provide larger space, more common ground for the two sides for further cooperation and coordination. CBN is good because it can reduce the risk of misperception between the two sides and avoid accidental conflict between the two sides. But Taiwan think the CBN shouldn't be as a midway toward the final political negotiation. For example, to talk about every detail about unification or to discuss the political relations between the two sides prior to unification. Of course, Chinese side is quite different. I think China focuses more on the process, in particular the end of process. And Taiwan focuses more on the practical function of the CBN. That means CBN, in China's views, is an important element toward Beijing's ultimate goal, that is national unification. For example, if we look at very closely about the Defense White Book released by China 2 years ago, we will find out that China not only talk about CBN, but also talk a lot about a peace agreement, peace accord, and ending the cross-strait hostilities. So it's kind of, I think, it's kind of unification package. And I believe that this kind of CBN is exactly Taiwan doesn't want to have. So you can see the huge difference here. And the last one is U.S. factor. I think basically Taiwan still very well care about U.S. attitude, position on these kind of issues. The reason quite simple. Taiwan doesn't want to cause any concern in the U.S. side that Taiwan is over-tilting toward China or leaning upon China. So this is the biggest, one of the biggest concerns in Taiwan. In particular, we know that over the past several years, the Obama administration is trying to formulating and implementing so-called pivot or rebalancing strategy toward Asia-Pacific. So that means in Taiwan's eyes, building cross-strait CBNs or signing a peace agreement between the two sides may trigger more political sensitivity. So that's one of the main reasons. And another issue in the U.S. factor is still armed self issues. A recent case, the meeting between Secretary Hagel and China Defense Minister Chang Wanquan just showed that on the one hand, China continue to press and lobby the U.S. Administration, including Congress, to terminate arms sales to Taiwan. On the other, I think China continue to link the issues of CBMs and arms sales, trying to say that Taiwan, you don't need to continue purchasing arms from the U.S. due to the recent good situation between the two sides. But actually, in Taiwan's eyes, arms sales, arms transfer links are very important. And we regard this kind of proposal, I mean, from China 2 years, as a kind of move trying to weaken the legitimacy of the kind of arms transfer links. So I think I stop here. Basically, these are three kind of explanations. I think we can discuss this later. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. For including me on this panel, I will try to add a few words, and then we can have a discussion and a Q&A period. I've been working on the issue of cross-strait CBMs for some time, actually beginning in 2001. I've discussed the issue at length with experts and officials on both sides of the strait. I will certainly in my presentation differentiate between what I see as my view or the views of others and the views of governments, and I think that's important to differentiate. I want to start by saying that there hasn't been much discussion yet of what sort of kind of CBMs we are talking about. I think Taiwan especially needs what I would call conflict avoidance measures rather than just pure confidence-building measures. I don't really hold the view that mutual trust is necessary for CBMs. This is a difference between just my own view and the general Western experience and the view that is held by many people in Taiwan, including by President Ma Ying-jeou. I would, in fact, argue that military CBMs are already being implemented. And for those of you who are familiar with the literature on confidence-building measures, you will know that there are such things as declaratory CBMs. So you could point to, for example, President Ma's three no's as being a unilateral declaratory CBM, or the declaration that Taiwan has made for years that it would not develop nuclear weapons as a unilateral declaratory CBM. Taiwan annually announces its military exercises. That is a unilateral transparency measure. Neither side of the strait has committed in any written form to not crossing the center line between the strait, but in fact they rarely do. There were a few occasions in the Chen Shui-bian era that China did deliberately send its fighters across the strait. I would call this separate unilateral restraint measures. So those are examples of some of the CBMs that are already underway. And so the question is, at what point do the two sides of the strait, if ever, move to bilaterally negotiated CBMs? And we have not yet seen that happen. The only bilateral CBM that I would point to, which is not specifically in the military sphere, but is between coast guards, is the annual exercise. I believe it's been held 3 years in a row now between Jinmen and Xiamen, which is a search and rescue exercise, which is to protect or provide capabilities to rescue somebody if the Xiao Santong, the three mini links, if there were to be an accident, which is a very functional CBMs. And I would argue that CBMs should be first and foremost functional. My argument has been that Taiwan should support confidence-building measures or conflict avoidance measures that, in fact, are more beneficial to Taipei than they are to Beijing, or at least even-handed. There are certainly CBMs that would benefit Beijing more than Taiwan, and given the fact that Taiwan is the party that is really under threat, I think that Taiwan really should emphasize those kind of CBMs that would serve its interests. So my point here is that it's important to get into specifics as to what the CBMs are that we're talking about. China has recently proposed to the United States that we have advanced notification of major military exercises. This is something that would be very much in Taiwan's interest if the two sides of the strait were to agree to something like that, putting hotlines in place that would enable reliable communication mechanisms if there were an accident. Setting rules of the road at sea, operational safety measures, is something else that could be done. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about what the specific CBMs are that I think would be useful, which are very different than what the mainland thinks about, and I will, I'll talk a bit about those in a minute. Professor Lee said that the change in Taiwan's position toward CBMs is subtle. I guess I would go a bit further and say it's really pretty clear. President Ma, before he came into office and after he came into office, was quite explicitly supportive of the possibility of a peace accord and military confidence-building measures. It's quite clear that neither of those are on his agenda for his second term. And Professor Lee talked about some of the reasons why the president has decided not to pursue CBMs. I'd like to just spend perhaps a minute on that because I have a couple of, I think, additions that I would make. I agree with his point that there is a lack of domestic consensus. this strong popular reaction during the recent presidential campaign to Ma's proposal in October 2011 that Taiwan could cautiously consider whether it should negotiate a peace agreement with China within the next decade led Ma to reconsider. So CBMs was part of this. Secondly, yes, Ma is absolutely worried about the U.S. factor. But I don't think he's worried about U.S. Concern that Taiwan will move forward with military confidence-building measures that would not serve Taiwan's interests. And I'll talk about U.S. policy at length later on. But what President Ma is really worried about, in my view, is that if Taiwan were to go ahead and pursue CBMs with the mainland, that it would result in a reduction and perhaps an end to arms sales to Taiwan. I've heard the president express this concern several times. And again, it's something that is perhaps there are reason to be concerned, particularly about maybe congressional support for arms sales to Taiwan. My own view is that that is not likely to be an outcome of certain kinds of CBM agreements between Taiwan and the mainland. But I appreciate that concern, and I think it's probably the foremost concern, I think, in President Ma's mind. Another reason is that the mainland has not demonstrated a willingness to increase Taiwan's security. And President Ma, I think, is wary that Beijing is just going to use CBMs as another means to make Taiwan more insecure and harm Taiwan's interests. And that goes back to the issue that both of our speakers have mentioned, that the mainland has consistently refused to reduce military deployments or the military threat to Taiwan. And then the fourth reason is that Ma believes that a peace accord should be signed prior to discussing CBMs. He believes that in the absence of mutual political trust, it is premature to discuss any real security or military issues with the mainland. And he has apparently decided that it's too early to discuss a peace accord. So again, this is not a view that I personally share, but it is quite widely shared actually within Taiwan and particularly within the Taiwan military based on discussions that I have had. So I want to say a bit about Beijing's approach to CBMs, and then I'll end by talking about U.S. policy on this issue. Generally, the Western approach to CBMs is to identify specific confidence-building measures or conflict avoidance measures that reduce the potential for miscalculation and accident, that establish greater predictability and increase the ability to manage and diffuse a crisis should one occur. And we can go back and look at various CBMs that were implemented between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Certainly, there wasn't a whole lot of political trust between those two countries, but they were able to implement things like, 1972, an incidents at sea agreement. And there are other such examples. So it's really a sort of bottom-up approach. You pursue very specific CBMs that have specific goals. And maybe over time you build habits of cooperation and the end result could be political trust. But most importantly, you're avoiding that outbreak of a crisis or an incident. This is what I think Washington is trying to do with Beijing today. We are specifically focusing on putting in place the kind of CBMs that would avoid an accident or enable our two countries to manage a crisis. I don't think anybody really expects we're going to see mutual trust between the U.S. and China overnight. But again, you build habits of cooperation over time, and perhaps you can make some progress. But, you know, China's approach and really Taiwan's approach, I think, is really quite different. It's really top-down. You establish some degree of political trust, and then you, and only then, can you put in place CBMs. Beijing proposes building what they often refer to as, the language in Chinese is actually different for CBMs between Taiwan and the mainland. And what the Chinese really call for is a confidence-building mechanism rather than very specific CBMs. I mean, it's viewed as sort of this package, this systematic approach. They see such a mechanism as part of a broader political process, again, that is aimed at building mutual trust and promoting reunification. So for them, again, this is top-down. Clearly, the mainland does not believe that CBMs can be designed to perpetuate the cross-strait status quo. This is something that concerns Taiwan, which, for the time being, does want to keep the status quo. So this is a difference between Beijing and Taiwan. One of the most important goals that I think China has is to promote a united front, and CBMs are part of this united front policy to win over the support of the Taiwan people for closer cross-strait relations and eventual peaceful reunification. And we can see this in the kind of CBMs that mainland scholars write about and those that they have mentioned when I have had discussions with people on the mainland. And I would emphasize these are mainland scholars, because in fact, this issue on the mainland hasn't really risen to the policy level. There has been no specific unit on the mainland that's been instructed to take the lead on this issue. Lots are doing research, which is also true of many cross-strait issues. So they recommend things like, you know, having a joint conversation between the two sides of the strait, military scholars like at national defense universities on, Xunzi Bingfa, Xunzi's art of war. They advocate studying cooperation between the CCP and the KMT in the anti-Japanese war. And more recently, of course, they advocate studies or concrete cooperation to defend the joint claims of the two sides of the strait in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. So these are very, very different kinds of CBMs than we see people on Taiwan recommending, or the kinds of CBMs that I think the United States would like to see happen. And then finally, on the Beijing perspective, cross-strait CBMs for Beijing are special. They are not comparable to CBMs between sovereign states. I personally don't think that is an obstacle between the two sides of the strait, because I don't think that President Ma would be pushing for CBMs to be something that would be representing sovereign states. So that's sometimes mentioned, but I don't think that's insurmountable. So let me then turn to my last section, which is on U.S. policy towards cross-strait CBMs. I would say that there is the United States supports cross-strait CBMs, but there is no policy of actively promoting them. And I think that that's an important distinction. The cross-strait agenda, whether it's CBMs or other issues, from the U.S. perspective, is up to the two sides of the strait to determine. The topics discussed, the pace of progress, is not something for the U.S. to decide. And I recall when Ray Burkhardt spoke at CSIS earlier this year, he said that the United States has never encouraged Taiwan to, or discouraged Taiwan to, talk about a specific issue in the cross-strait context. So we are, I think the United States wants very much to have an open, detailed dialogue with Taiwan about how it thinks about its relations with the mainland, where it's going, what it would like to enter into negotiations with or not. But we don't push, we don't pressure Taiwan to engage in any dialogue that on any issue that Taiwan views as premature. This is something that is left completely up to Taiwan to decide based on its assessment of its own interests and the views of the 23 million people of Taiwan. And I think that the United States has the utmost confidence that Taiwan can decide for itself what is in its interests. Now, some U.S. officials have, in the past, voiced support for cross-strait CBMs. And I think this is important to note because it has been said by U.S. officials And this runs contrary to what we hear from people from the mainland who say the United States opposes cross-strait CBMs. And indeed, some people from the mainland argue that U.S. officials have strongly told the Ma Ying-jeou regime, you will not talk about this with the mainland, which is, of course, nonsense. So you can look back. I think the most senior statement that was made was by Jim Steinberg in September of 2009. When he was giving a speech on policy toward China at the Center for New American Security. And he said, we encourage both China and Taiwan to explore confidence-building steps that will lead to closer ties and greater stability across the Taiwan Strait. That was a very, very clear statement. I'm not sure it was completely vetted throughout the U.S. government. There were people who were unhappy with several of the things that Jim Steinberg said in that speech, and I think that was one of them. And Taiwan apparently expressed some concern to the United States because, again, it didn't want to appear to be pressured by the United States to undertake a dialogue that it felt was premature. It is important to note that it was just a couple of weeks later at the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council that a speech was given by then Assistant Secretary of State of Defense, Chip Gregson. And he suggested that U.S. support for military CBMs was not intended to signal that the Obama administration was pressuring Taiwan to begin these negotiations. So he said, we are encouraged by the PRC's reciprocity in encouraging renewed interactions in cultural and economic affairs, but we have not yet seen similar progress or dialogue in military affairs. We encourage both sides to consider such steps at the appropriate time and in a mutually agreed manner. So I think this is pretty clear that the U.S. encourages such a dialogue between the two sides of the strait when they are ready. And this is based on, I think, Western experience in confidence-building measures. I think we also believe that it's important to avoid an accident or to put in place the kind of communication mechanisms that would enable both sides to prevent an accident from escalating should one occur. We drew these conclusions from our own experience with the collision between the Chinese fighter and the U.S. EP-3 in 2001. And we believe, I think, that when relations between the two sides of the strait are somewhat improved, there's eased tensions, this is an opportunity to maybe put in place mechanisms that might function when and if tensions increase again between the two sides of the strait. Now, there's never any certainty that measures are going to work. And if you examine examples around the world, you know, between, you know, the PLO in Israel, there's examples of CBMs that have not worked very well. But there are many that have, and there's an opportunity to use this period of improved cross-strait relations to think about putting some of these mechanisms in place. So, therefore, I think it's clear that it is not accurate to say that the U.S. opposes cross-strait military CBMs or that it discourages Taiwan from discussing military CBMs with the mainland. And it is, I would just close by saying that this position by the United States has been conveyed quite clearly to mainland China, certainly when Wang Yi was head of the Taiwan Affairs Office. He came to Washington, talked with U.S. officials, raised this question because he was quite concerned and once again was told the United States supports CBMs if and when Taiwan is ready to discuss them. The mainland, of course, wants the United States to call publicly for President Ma, not only to talk about military CBMs, but also to talk about other issues like a peace accord. This is certainly not something that the United States is going to do. But I do think it's important to understand how the U.S. views this issue and whether or not the U.S. would, in any case, you know, be more vocal under what circumstances that could be reconsidered in the future. So I will stop there.
I think our presentation today really filled out kind of the sub-theme of the roundtable today, which is the goal between far and near. that everybody can kind of agree that confidence building measures are good as a far goal, but the near, it's getting from the far to the near that's the real problem, and that's about implementation and definition and desirability on all sides involved. So I think it's a very good start for discussion. We'll now open it to questions or comments. If as you do that, raise your hand and identify yourself. If you have a specific question to one of the specific panelists, please identify who you want to talk to, and then we'll go on. So start from here. I think, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm Chen Weihua, China Daily. Yeah, I would ask, and some of you actually argued it's the mainland who refused to renounce the use of force. But some Chinese scholars seem to argue that the causal relationship has been distorted.
Taiwan has refused to
renounce independence. I mean, it's not just my NGO, other leaders that may come to office. And it's also the U.S. arms sales, Taiwan, actually, that resulted all these two resulting in mainland, okay, deploying all those missiles at Taiwan. So is that a distortion of this relationship? Thank you.
I think the one thing I would say, I understand the logic that you're putting forward. But what I, at least is to my knowledge, and others here, including Bonnie, may have a different understanding, is that the PRC has also not said, although they've said that possible use of force would be directed against independence or against foreign interference, or, you know, they've got a sort of a list of things. They've not done the other thing, which is to say that so long as Taiwan doesn't move toward independence, that they would not use force. So it's not just a general refusal to renounce the use of force. It's somewhat more specific than that. The anti-secession law obviously lays out three areas where if there were something to happen, then they would resort to non-peaceful means. And one could infer from that you know, those are the specifics. But I still am not aware of a statement from the mainland that only in those circumstances would they do that. And then you, of course, have the problem that a government in Taiwan, a democratic government, as Li Dajong pointed out, lots of people have different views. And so what President Ma has done is said, as long as he's in office, there will be no independence. There will also be no unification. But he has made that statement. And I've not seen a reciprocal statement basically coming out of Beijing. So it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg issue, but certainly the underlying threat, the continuing building of the capacity, which is growing to deal with Taiwan and independence in a situation where I think it is politically totally infeasible for any government to be elected and to advocate movement toward de jure independence, the lack of any statement from the other side is pretty noticeable.
I would argue that the Bush administration convinced Beijing that it does not support Taiwan independence. I hear this frequently from people in China. Prior to President Bush making the statement that he did alongside Wen Jiabao expressing concerns about some of Taiwan's policies, I think there actually was worry in Beijing, and some people believed that the United States preferred an independent Taiwan. George W. Bush privately told Beijing's leaders that the United States opposed Taiwan independence. And his deeds matched his words. And so I believe that the Chinese are quite confident now that the United States does not support independence. I think Alan said earlier that they're not convinced that the United States will accept any outcome that's worked out between the two sides. And certainly the mainland's not convinced that we would accept peaceful reunification is one of those possible outcomes. That has yet to be tested. But I would say that U.S. arms sales to Taiwan pretty clearly is not going to help Taiwan launch an offensive against the mainland. So we're not really looking at capability that threatens the mainland. These are really primarily defensive arms. And so I think from my perspective, the logic that makes sense is that China reduces the threat opposite Taiwan. Taiwan might then reconsider or factor that into the decisions that it makes about the arms it needs to buy, about the defense capabilities that it needs to have. And then if Taiwan does not request certain systems from the United States, or maybe feels it doesn't need to buy weapons from the United States, well, that's its prerogative. So to me, that's the logic that really makes sense, rather than the U.S. stops arms sales and then China renounces the use of force and readjusts its military deployments. Certainly, I would say that there should be no U.S.-China agreement over Taiwan's head, which is what Xi Jinping and General Chang reportedly have proposed.
You can use the speaker. Press the button, the green button.
Okay. Does it work okay now?
Yep.
Thank you. I'm Andre Sauvageau, and I'm the chief representative in Vietnam for the Interstate Traveler Company in Detroit, Michigan. I used to represent General Electric there and all that. But anyway, my question is really for Mr. Rombeck, because all the presentations were wonderful and great, but I just wondered, you know, you made the comment, sir, that China isn't looking for a fight, and I agree with that, but my question is, why is the leadership in Beijing so lacking in pragmatism in continuing to unite so many countries against their obvious aggression, use of violence, and the threat of violence? Many of my business trips in Vietnam, I've seen Chinese warships come into the exclusive economic zone within 200 miles of the Vietnamese exclusive economic zone, and the same thing with the Philippines. And so my question is just that. I mean, don't they see that their real interests are not well served by these acts of violence and threats of violence?
I think that we saw in 2009, 2010, variety of activities on the part of the PRC that, in fact, were particularly concerning to its neighbors and had the kind of effect on their attitudes that you describe. My sense is that they looked at that, didn't find that really working very well, and pulled back a bit from that in 2011. Now, we've seen certain specific instances where China has acted more assertively, but the argument they would make is that it's in response to actions by others to change the status quo. That was true in Scarborough Shoal by the Philippines. It's true in Diaoyu Senkaku by Japan. I'm saying this is their perception of how it went. So from that point of view, I think their position would be, we're not acting in a threatening way. We are responding to actions by others who would change the status quo. You can judge whether that's an excuse or genuine, but I think, you know, that is its rationale. I also mentioned that having PLA Navy ships within the EEZ is not illegal. It's not an act or a threat. It may not be all that welcome, but then U.S. naval vessels inside the Chinese EEZ is not welcome to China. So, I mean, there are a lot of differences in how countries look at these things and what is and what isn't a threat. But I would stick with what I said. I think that, yes, they may take actions which do upset their neighbors, and I think they need to make, and I'm sure they do make, a calculation about what the net effect of that is going to be on their interests. I think sometimes, as I say, in 2009, 2010, they probably went too far in terms of their own judgments at the end of the day. But I'm sure this is not done sort of willy-nilly. This is considered. You and I might reach a different judgment from the one they would reach. But I really think that they are very hopeful not to do this certainly using military force. And in, even in the instances of Scarborough Shoal and the Diaoyu Senkaku issue, they have not basically used military force. They're relying on civilian vessels. I mean, there is a military component sort of underneath all of this. But anyway, Bonnie, do you want to?
Okay, Zhong Jianzhen from Department of Diplomacy, National Chinese University. Three of you always mentioned something about the mass decision-making, including mass himself and the domestic politics. But with regard to CBM, I think one another factor maybe you know better than me, that is the military top brass. This generation military leaders, they have different mindset, different training, they have different experience with last generation military top brass. Like Lee's father maybe belongs to last generation, so they might have more contact with mainland China. But how about Lee's generation? They might have some different kind of perspective. I believe that Ma pretty much relies upon military professionalism. So that's one, I think, very important factors. I don't know, Alan and Bonnie, you have traveled lots to Taiwan, maybe especially Bonnie, you have contact with the military sector. So how about your feelings, your about the opinions about the military top brass? And Da Zhong also, you teach military and security studies. So, of course, your students might have many top brass. So your experience or your opinions about it. Okay, thank you.
I think it's a very good, interesting question. What I heard in my classroom and what I talk about with some military brass, I heard different kind of opinion on that. Some of them are still very conservative. They don't want to criticize their maybe earlier superior, but they do have this kind of concerns because it's something to do with the, how to say, honor, pride, the most important core values of ROC armed forces. Because as I just mentioned in my presentation, it's a long mission, has long been the mission of ROC armed forces. And the threat from China mainland cannot be changed overnight. So they worry about these kind of things. Not only worry about that CBM may constrain Thai military defense capability, they do care about this kind of issue. So, but some, of course, it's kind of still very controversial, but some very young military officers do have different kind of view. As you just mentioned, they think that these kind of things, we can have this kind, certain kind of flexibility. For example, they argue that why not the two sides can co-host different kind of academic conferences, workshops, like today's panel discussion. Like professor from both sides, military academy, participate in kind of activities. And we can choose certain kind of topics to discuss. For example, non-security issues, such as humanitarian aid, disaster relief, search and rescue, counter-piracy. I think this kind of issue, they believe, can contribute to the future. Maybe they can pave way for more bilateral military exchanges between the two sides. So again, I think this, we don't have any kind of consensus among Taiwan's military brass because too sensitive. Thanks.
I would just add that at times when Taiwan's president is interested in having experts and officials do research on this issue, there are a lot of different opinions that come out. And I saw this under Chen Shui-bian and in Ma Ying-jeou's early years. Different suggestions, different perspectives, different senses of what the precondition should be. But once the president makes clear this is not going forward, the debate ends. Nobody wants to talk about it anymore, which is understandable. But I would say that there are senior people in Taiwan's military who agree with President Ma's approach, that there must be a degree of political trust first, concern that the mainland will use this to promote its own security and weaken Taiwan's security. So there is there is a convergence and certainly concern about the impact on U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. So, you know, I have found that that view has prevailed. Whether it's prevailed only because it's the president's view, I don't know. But I do think that among the senior officers in Taiwan, that is seems to me to be the prevailing or the predominant view as well. And so it's a minority view that there does not have to be political trust before you pursue some kind of conflict avoidance measures.
In the middle here.
Thank you. My name is Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency of Hong Kong. Beijing today rejected Taipei's idea that Ma Ying-jeou could join the APEC summit this year or next year. And the spokesman of China Foreign Affairs Ministry said this issue should follow the tradition and MOU of APEC. Do you have any comments on this new development? And what is the reason that do you think that President Ma proposed this idea at this moment? And how possible do you think that the summit between Xi Jinping and Ma Ying-jeou could be held in the next 2 years? Thank you.
Frankly, I hadn't seen the foreign ministry statement. I'm not shocked, however. Guo Taiban, Fudren, and Sun Yafu basically had signaled this the other day when he drew a distinction between going to APEC and a possible Sima meeting. Okay, and he made the point that I gather the foreign ministry statement, foreign ministry spokesman made, which is that any invitation or participation at the APEC leaders' meeting should follow convention that has been established. Now, of course, Beijing has established it. And although it is true, as Ma Ying-jeou has said, that these are economies and these are leaders of the economies, nonetheless, they also are heads of state or heads of government. And so the perception that somehow he could go there and avoid creating the atmosphere of the President of the Republic of China being there, I think, was hopeful, shall we say. And certainly, as you're reporting it, and as Sun Yafu said, beyond what they're willing to think about. On the meeting between Xi and Ma, it seems to me what Sun said was, that would be a good thing, but conditions need to be created. Now, on the other hand, President Ma has said that it needs any such activity needs to have the support of the people and preserve dignity. And one make those things all mesh? I don't know. I think it's not easy. And we'll just have to see what happens. I don't think it's the highest priority for the Ma administration or President Ma, but he obviously is interested in it, and he has indicated that. Why did he indicate he'd like to go to APEC? I think that he's interested in promoting a sense of Taiwan's international participation, not in a way that's going to challenge Beijing on the sovereignty question, specifically saying he would go as a head of an economy and not in a presidential capacity. Of course, everybody else would presumably go there in the same capacity from his perspective. I think indicates how he's trying to thread that needle, as it were, and find a way to do that. But it's not the same, obviously, as what Chen Shui-bian was trying to do in terms of promoting some sense of a different sovereign entity. So I'm not surprised. I think that it would be a good thing from President Ma's point of view to have a greater sense of Taiwan's legitimacy in the international community without, again, directly challenging the issue of sovereignty. But we'll just have to see what eventuates. It's interesting, though, that the foreign ministry has now formalized what Sun indicated the other day.
I would just add that one of the reasons that Beijing is concerned about giving Taiwan too much international space in general, and certainly having President Ma attend APEC would would also be part of this this issue, is that it sets a certain precedent that if the DPP were to return to power, that might really be seen by Beijing as creating, you know, two Chinas in or one China, one Taiwan in the international system. It might be possible to not issue, for example, if Beijing didn't want to issue an invitation for Taiwan to be an observership at WHA, if a DPP president came to power, Beijing might be able to do that. Reversing that, to me, is one example, but reversing having a president from Taiwan go to APEC is, I mean, that would really get the attention of the entire international community. I think Beijing is just very, very reluctant to set that precedent. And on the possibility of a summit, I guess my view is that Ma Ying-jeou can attend APEC as the leader of an economy because it's a group of economies. But I think it's hard for him to meet with Xi Jinping as the head of an economy. And I don't think he's going to meet with Xi Jinping as head of a party either, because that goes to the issue of Taiwan's dignity and really wouldn't get the support, I think, of the Taiwan people. So it has to be, as the president of the ROC, and Beijing has yet to come to terms with the legitimacy of the ROC, and I think the likelihood of them doing so in the next 2 years is quite slim.
So we're beginning to run out of time, so what I'm going to do is let people, a number of people ask questions, and then we'll see how you want to answer them, and then we'll so start here, and then we'll move around the room. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Peter Lee. I'm the new school to Elliott School. Actually, my question is, I was wondering how the U.S. government view the role that Taiwan is playing in the in the chain of the island, which is combined with Japan, Taiwan, and the Philippines. I mean, recently I've seen on the White House website that the Obama administration is has been deepening the military cooperation between Japan and the Philippines and even Korea. So, I mean, if the U.S. government is really think that the role that Taiwan is playing now is really important, then why the U.S. government doesn't offer the same maybe military offers to Taiwan as they as it do to the Philippines and Japan?
Okay, let me go around the Garrett.
Garrett Van Der Weis, editor of Taiwan Communique. I had a question for Professor Lee Dajong. But first, a small comment on what Bonnie said. You said that the U.S. Position was that it doesn't support Taiwan independence. It also says that it doesn't oppose it as long as there is a peaceful resolution. In the same fashion, the U.S. doesn't oppose unification or support unification as long as it could be achieved peacefully. And I think that whole picture, it's good to emphasize that. For Professor Lee, you talked about the domestic concerns in Taiwan vis-a-vis cross-strait relations. Yes, people want to have a peaceful approach across the strait. I think everybody agrees on that. But in spite of the rapprochement by the Ma government, we have seen that China continues to build up its arms across the Taiwan Strait. Its missiles are increasing. And this is part of the reason why the Ma popularity has gone down, down, and down. And now it's about 14%, I understand. And actually, the support for independence during the Ma government years has increased. Popular opinion polls do show that. So the best CBM for to be taken across the strait is for China to dismantle its missiles and to stop this arms race. But we haven't seen anything like that happening. So in view of that fact, how do you see the popular opinion in Taiwan developing over the next 2 years and, of course, leading up to the 2016 elections? Thank you.
Anybody else? Short questions only there and then Michael. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Jin Ling Wen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. I follow the question about the economic and APEC. What is the view you think about Taiwan joining TPP or RCEP?
Mike?
Mike Fonte, I'm the director of the DPP's office here in Washington. Just want to make an announcement that any of you interested in the DPP's defense papers, they just issued those. We have them available both in English and 3 out of the 4 in Chinese. It might give you some background for how the DPP is viewing some of the issues at play here, both in terms of the defense of Taiwan from a DPP perspective and confidence-building possibilities. Also want to remind everybody that DPP's position on the issue is that Taiwan's sovereign and independent. If you want to change that, because Taiwan's a democracy, there has to be some kind of democratic vote on that. And I guess the question then is, it links to some of the other issues, is this is where hearts and minds come in, winning hearts and minds, and I think that's what I'd like to know, how that view comes across when you're talking to people in the PRC. Do they really understand that that's their agenda at this point, to change that opinion poll, which always goes up between 60% and 70% about support for status quo? Because it seems to me that's where China is going to be able to manage the cross-strait relations best if they win the hearts and minds. That's what at least is a DPP position. Thanks.
Okay, I'll let the panelists answer whatever you want to answer. We have to be out of here by 2 o'clock, though, so in no particular order.
First one.
Okay. Dajong, do you want to take
on? Okay. I don't think that any U.S. official has ever said publicly, and Alan, correct me if I'm wrong, that the United States specifically supports Taiwan independence if it were worked out between the two sides of the strait. The U.S. position is we will accept any outcome that's negotiated between the two sides of the strait. So it's implicit, but I can't find any statement that a U.S. official has said, if the two sides agree on Taiwan independence, we will accept it. So if you have seen such a statement, I'd be interested in it. But I agree with you, it's implicit. Never seen that stated explicitly. On Mike Fonte's question, I think that the Chinese are always grappling with the sometimes contradictory goals of peace for reunification and protecting what they see as China's own interest and advancing the cause of winning over hearts and minds. I think that they are actually quite serious about winning over hearts and minds. And there are a number of mainland scholars who have a pretty forward-leaning position on how to do that, that would imply reconsideration of some existing policies. So it's hard to know whether policies will eventually come in line with that. But when, for the moment, I would say that when mainland interests, as they are currently perceived, are not consistent with what perhaps you and I might see as winning over hearts and minds, they choose the former. But I don't think they're just paying lip service to it. I think they are actually serious, because they know at the end of the day there isn't going to be any form of peaceful reunification or China under one roof or whatever you want to call it without some understanding and support from the majority of people in Taiwan. And the last one that I want to answer is just the issue of Taiwan joining RCEP and TPP. Alan and I were just with several experts in a delegation that I organized to go to the mainland and Taiwan. And I have to admit that one of my real takeaways from discussions in Taiwan is the seriousness within which experts and officials in Taiwan are thinking about the need to integrate Taiwan into the regional economic integration process, from which Taiwan has really been marginalized. There is a recognition that Taiwan needs to accelerate its process of negotiating bilateral FTAs, which you didn't mention. We have seen the first sort of quasi-FTA reached with New Zealand. The second will be announced soon with Singapore. It is not a coincidence, we were told, that these are two countries who are founding members of the TPP. So this is a goal that the mainland has in mind, I mean that Taiwan has in mind. Ma Ying-jeou, of course, said that it would be first 10 years, then he said within 8 years, which would now mean within 7 years since it was said last year. And there are officials who say the sooner the better. No reason it has to be 7 years. But what I'm heartened by is the discussions within Taiwan about the understanding that they do need to make tough choices, that in signing these agreements with other nations, they have to There will be some winners. There will be some losers. And maybe there will have to be some policies that will be implemented to help losers to transition to, you know, new sectors, for example. But there is deep interest in joining the TPP. This is not a political issue. Those who say that Taiwan should be invited by the United States to the TPP don't understand this issue. We don't own it. But if Taiwan gets itself ready as an economy, then other economies are going to want to include Taiwan in this process. Not going to happen in the near term. But I sense really that, very different from my prior visit to Taiwan, that this is a goal and that people understand that this is critically important for Taiwan's national security. And last, I would say RCEP is also on the agenda. You know, some people want to do make sure they're doing both because they fear that doing just RCEP would be seen as siding too much with China's version of the regional economic integration. I would argue that they're complementary. And I would just add that one of the things we heard from an official on the mainland was that it is understandable that Taiwan wants to join RCEP. And this is, in fact, seen as something that Beijing might be able to work with Taipei on. So obviously, there's going to have to be some consultations, but Beijing seems to sympathize with this goal of Taiwan wanting to be more participatory in the regional economic integration process.
I think although the U.S. and Taiwan doesn't have any formal kind of diplomatic ties, but the security ties and untransferable links between the two sides remain very strong. I think since over the past several years, the U.S. has sold, I think, more than 18 U.S. billion dollars arms sale package to Taiwan. If you look at the content, the quality, quantity, I think it's still very robust. So although we don't have the kind of formal relations, so we value these kind of arms transfer links. And I think these kind of links has always been the most high-level, high-profile elements in U.S.-China relations. So nowadays, I think countries love to talk about core interest, vital interest, something like this. In my view, these kind of arms transfer links is one of Taiwan's core interests. I think since 1979, TRA, security commitment to Taiwan, and arms sales remain very, very important. We know that cross-strait relations are quite it's a very hard issue. So we need to care about the mainstream public opinion in Taiwan. According to MAC public poll, more than 80% of Taiwanese people still supporting maintaining the status quo. I think it's a very important important information for any kind of Taiwanese government to proceed a future cross-strait relations, no matter DPP or KMT. I think the bottom line, we need to listen to the people, listen to Taiwan's mainstream public opinion. It's a very fundamental thing.
Since we've got 30 seconds, I would say I agree with what's been said by my colleagues. Garrett, two things. One is actually Rich Armitage did say something about why wouldn't we support Taiwan independence if the two sides agree, which is what I said earlier, but he was an official at the time he said it. That didn't resonate with a lot of people as the position the United States should be articulating because it would be misunderstood.
He was an official
when he said it. But in any case, the U.S. does not. Bonnie's absolutely correct. The U.S. does not, as a matter of general practice, talk about outcomes. And one of the things the PRC is frustrated with is that we won't say that if the two sides agreed on it, we would support unification, right? So we don't say if the two sides agree on it, we would support independence. What we say is what Bonnie said we say. Any outcome the two sides agree on peacefully, willingly, non-coercively, we go along with.
I was referring to the statements made in 1998 after President Clinton's quite a heated debate about this particular issue, and that was the response from the State Department.
That
basically, U.S. is agnostic to the outcome.
And specifically, U.S. would support independence?
No.
Well, we really have to bring this to an end.
No,
I just want to... I just want to announce that we actually have another Taiwan event coming up on September 9th, Monday, September 9th, with Professor Liu Yejong from National Zhengzhou University on Taiwan and the pivot towards Asia. So look forward, that's already out in our announcements. Anyway, I want to thank our panel for an illuminating session and welcome you all back to our future events.
Thank you. I look forward to reading your article. Always good to share a panel with you.